Can everybody hear me okay? Cool. Such a lovely sunny day outside. It's a shame you have to listen to me sitting in here. But thank you for coming. My name is Kaustubh Srikant, also sometimes referred to as Houndbee. I work for an organization called Tactical Tech. And amongst other things, Tactical Tech works in helping rights activists and journalists understand their security and privacy risks. We have a table outside at the noisy square. I encourage you to come talk to us and look at some of our resources, especially if you want to help your non-technical friends understand how they can protect their communications and data. Today, however, I'm not here to talk about my work at Tactical Tech, but talk to you about something I've been thinking about, observing, analyzing, and researching for the last little while. So the government of India, over the last few years, the government of the country I grew up in, the government of the country I've spent most of my life in, has made a series of decisions. A series of decisions which have taken a form of several databases and schemes they've implemented to collect, analyze, monitor, and intercept our personal information. And I've been thinking about how this affects a democracy as large as India and what kind of implications this has on our personal liberties. So I'm going to share some of my observations with you today and some of the questions I have, and with a little bit of help, hopefully, from you, try and find answers to these questions. Before I continue, I should thank Maria from Center for Internet and Society, who did a brilliant talk yesterday about the state of surveillance in India at the moment. She's going to be a tough act to follow, but I hope to add some more value to the conversation she started yesterday. So there's this there's a lot of dialogue around privacy that we all talk about all over the place today. And there's a specific dialogue in India around the whole concept of privacy and what that means in the Indian context. There is also this notion that there is a lack of enthusiasm around privacy in India. And why is that? Is it because the social values around privacy are different in a country like India when you compare it to the West? Or is it that Indians don't care about privacy at all? Also, the fact that there's a very large, very diverse population of about 1.2 billion people living in that country means that country has a very diverse set of problems. People say, we don't really need to care about privacy because we have larger problems such as poverty and corruption that we need to solve. And therefore, a lot of schemes that have been implemented to either solve problems such as corruption and poverty or combat terrorism are justified. That's what the Indian government has been saying for a little while. What I think about this is surveilling a large state such as this, or surveilling any state and its citizens, is an extremely totalitarian concept. It has led to totalitarian regimes in the past, and historically we know that building massive databases of citizens' personal data has usually led to limiting our personal freedoms. So why is it, after we've debated this and spoken about this for so long now, that one of the world's largest democracies, when it comes to the number of people who live there, is adopting this totalitarian idea? And what is their justification to do this? This is an old argument we all know, the argument that a lot of states use around national security. It's like, if you don't give up your personal information, the state is not going to be able to give you welfare or protect you. There's also, this argument is flawed because there just is, we know historically there isn't enough evidence to actually prove that this works. This is not something I'm going to get into a lot. This is a conversation we've had a lot over the last 4 days, and there are other people who can probably have this discussion better than I can. I'm going to talk about the Indian context a little more, about the notion that Indians don't care about privacy. Simon Davies said this a little while ago, says the Indian train syndrome, in which total strangers will disclose their lives on a train to complete strangers. And this is true. It's very commonplace for me to be in a situation in many places and many environments in India where I am asked very personal questions such as, how many children I have, or how much money do I make, or if I don't have children, why? When am I going to have them? And I'm used to these questions, and sometimes I avoid answering them, sometimes I answer them and I get into a debate about them, but it is also very commonplace for people to actually give out this information very readily. But does that mean that people don't care about privacy in India? Now, going back to this, the Indian train syndrome, when there is a lot of personal information exchanged very readily in a train if you're traveling with a few strangers, at the end of that exchange, if you're exchanging email addresses, people usually don't hand out their passwords also. So, yeah, there are things people think about when it comes to privacy. It's just thought of slightly differently, considering how diverse the context is there. There is a study that a department called PRECOG at the Indraprastha Institute of Information Technology in Delhi did. This is, of course, based on sample data. This is, keep that in mind. But what their research shows is that about 46% of the people who participated in this survey read the privacy policies and the terms of conditions while signing up with services online. It also showed that about 63% of the participants, when they get onto Facebook or another social network, change the default privacy settings. And almost 72% people mention deleting their personal data from their cell phones before they sell it. So people are clearly thinking about privacy, especially when it comes to the digital, when it comes to how we interact with digital technology and how we share and access information online. So yes, I think we do care, especially when it comes to our digital privacy. Let's just quickly think about what is this thing called privacy anyway. It's thought about differently in different ways. I'm just going to look at what kind of personal freedoms does the law give us, or and what that means to our personal civil liberties in the digital context. But to start with, the Black Laws Dictionary says privacy is basically the right to be left alone, the right of a person to be free from unwarranted publicity, the right to live without unwarranted interference by the public in matters with which the public is not necessarily concerned. And do we have any rights that actually give us these liberties? This is what the Universal Declaration of Human Rights says. No one shall be subjected to arbitrary interference with his privacy, family, home, or correspondence, nor to attacks upon his honor and reputation. Everyone has the right to protection of the law against such interference or attacks. Now, back home in the Indian context, the Constitution of India, this is one of the most basic fundamental rights defined in the Constitution of India, where the Article 21 of the Constitution says, No person shall be deprived of his life or personal liberty except according to procedure established by law. Now, what are the laws? Also, before we talk about the laws that govern telecommunications and our digital freedoms in the country, let's also look at one more thing which says, no person accused of any offense shall be compelled to be a witness against himself. Which means I have the right to not give away any information that is personal to me unless I am being investigated for an offense. That is the right to silence, which is again defined in the Constitution of India. The law that mandates a lot of telecommunications, how telecommunications are governed in the country, is a very old act called the Indian Telegraph Act. It dates back to 1885. What it says is that you can't actually intercept my communications unless it's a matter of public safety or if it's a public emergency. Let me take you back to the year 2008 for a second. 2008 was an extremely important year for a lot of us in India. There were two landmark events that really define how we think about or understand digital freedoms in the country and how the government has been making these decisions that impact these freedoms today. There was one event which was horrifying, it deeply shocked us and saddened all of us. This was the terror attacks of 26th of November 2008 in the city of Mumbai. This attack is commonly also called India's 9/11. The second event that also saddens me personally and a lot of us is the fact that there was an amendment to the Information Technology Act called the IT Amendment Act of 2008, which essentially now gives the government complete control over intercepting your communications without the need of a court order or a warrant. There's a couple of things that the IT Act removed from what the Telegraph Act had. Now the Indian government does not just intercept your communication if it's a matter of public safety or public emergency. They can come after you under the pretense of investigating any offense. So I'm going to talk about some recent developments, some of the schemes and systems that I just started talking about that the Indian government has been establishing. A few years ago, the government decided to build a massive database of citizens' personal data and store it centrally and set out on collecting data about a citizen, including their biometric information. They set up something called the National Population Register, which was supposed to be launched with the census. And what this was going to do is collect 13 categories of demographic information of every Indian resident, every resident in India, and also 3 categories of biometric data collected from all residents aged over the years 5 and above. And the NPR, signing up with the NPR was mandatory. So you had to give up this personal data. What they did not have anything in writing about was about the collection of your biometric data, your fingerprints, your iris scans. They did not define this, but they went out and started doing this anyway. The primary objective of the National Population Register was to assist in improving security by checking for illegal migration. They also had a few secondary objectives. Now, these I find extremely vague. They don't really have any clear definitions. They say, oh, we're going to provide services under several government schemes and programs using the NPR. This will also help us check for identity frauds, and it will help us improve planning. We don't know how they intend to do all of these things using that data. There is really not much information that has been disclosed about how this data is going to be used. Another interesting project, which has been a subject of much debate and controversy and a lot of conversations and dialogue around, is what the Indian government set up as a part of the planning commission, as a part of a planning commission's initiative called the UIDAI, which is the Unique Identification Authority of India, is something called the Unique Identification Project, also very commonly known as the Aadhaar Project. What the UID intends to do is provide every citizen in the country with a unique 12-digit number. They also say this is not mandatory. You only sign up for the UID if you wish to. This is the bit that I find extremely problematic about the Unique Identification Project. The UIDAI has decided that it will collect all this data, build this massive database, and store it all in a centralized location. This includes all our personally identifiable information, which is my name, my father's name, my religion, where I live, what I do, and my fingerprints and my iris scans. All of this stored in one massive centralized database. A volunteer of the UIDAI said this: what is Aadhaar? It's an unadulterated identity program that answers one question: is the individual who he or she claims to be? Now also, remember I said enrollment in the UID program is voluntary? Now, is that really true? Because I actually, a few days ago, just before I came to Berlin, I was in Bangalore, and I got an SMS which said, so we have something called the direct benefits scheme in India, which gives us a lot of subsidies. And one of the subsidies I get as being an Indian citizen is subsidies on the cooking gas we use at home to cook food every day. So we actually get to buy this at a subsidized rate from the government, as long as we are buying it straight from a government authorized agency. So this SMS said, you have to register before the end of the year with your UID number with the gas agency, otherwise we're not going to give you these subsidies. So there are other agencies that are being bullied into accept only providing these services if a citizen has a UID number. Even if the UIDAI actually says this is voluntary, a lot of other organizations, other institutions, and government authorities are now making it mandatory for a citizen interacting with that specific agency to provide a UID number to avail these services. The Maharashtra government even said, oh, you know what, we're not going to register any marriages in the country anymore unless you have a UID number. So you can't actually get married unless you just have this voluntary number and then go to the marriage bureau. Fortunately, the Supreme Court of India in September made a ruling which said the Aadhaar is actually not mandatory. Now, we'll see how that plays out. So why did Aadhaar come into being anyway? Why is it that we need the UID? Why does everybody need this UID number? Why is there the need for this database of people in the country? The government says there's a very large migrant culture in India, and there is no central identity that has been provided traditionally to an Indian citizen. There is something called the ration card, which I can get access to in the state I'm living in, which gives me certain benefits that I can access from the state. But if I decide to move to another state, the ration card is not valid anymore, which means I don't have another identification document which I can use to avail any services or benefits as a citizen of India. So they said it'll solve that problem. Everyone's going to have one centrally issued ID. They also want to use this program to give direct benefits to the rural and the urban poor, people who are under what we call the below poverty line. They have a program called Cash for Food, which intends to directly transfer money to citizens into their bank account, as long as they have a bank account which is linked to their UID number, they can get money straight into their bank accounts so they can actually buy food. So those were the primary two justifications that the government said is why we need the Aadhaar card. Now, there's a few other things that have been worrying me about the Aadhaar card, which I want to talk about for the next few minutes. The UIDAI decided that, the only way we can build a large technical secure system such as this is by actually working with private vendors who have the expertise that the government of India does not possess. They went out and negotiated several partnerships with large enterprises and private contractors to make this whole system happen. So a big part of this is actually privatized. Now, there's a few companies that are involved, more than a dozen private companies that are involved in the UIDAI project. And as I was looking at the list and talking to some other people, there's some information that has been coming to surface, which actually worries us about how and why did the government make the decisions to conduct business with certain companies. One of the companies is an American company called L1. Now, L1 is a company that claims on their website that they provide highly specialized government consulting services that address the most important challenges facing US defense and global security. They also claim that they have more than 1,000 specialists, most holding top security clearance. There is another company, and yeah, this is the interesting bit about L1. So George Tenet, he's a former CIA chief, actually sits on the board of L1. Tim Shorrock, who's an investigative journalist, actually looked into this and actually uncovered these links between George Tenet and the CIA and L1, and also established that actually one of the biggest clients L1 have are the CIA. Accenture is a large global enterprise. I'm sure a lot of us have heard of them. They also have links of working with US intelligence agencies for several years now. In 2012, they were actually awarded a large contract to do biosurveillance by the Department of Homeland Security in the United States. This is another company that is doing a large part of the work for the UIDAI and making the UID project happen. And more recently, Max Schierson, who is the CEO of MongoDB. MongoDB is, I'm sure a lot of technologists here and maybe others are familiar with MongoDB. It's an open source database system, which is actually quite an amazing system. But it is developed by a private company. And the UIDAI started talking to MongoDB to try and use their technology and their services to capture and analyze data of over 1 billion citizens who are going to register with the UIDAI. Now, the MongoDB, interestingly, receives a chunk of its funding from a venture capital that is owned by the CIA called InQtel. It's actually quite commonplace for a lot of open source projects or other technology companies to receive funding from intelligence agencies. It's not the first time we've heard of it. And sometimes it's had great results. We've had some great software being written by money that has been spent by intelligence agencies. But that's not the problem here. It's like, why is it that the Indian government consistently has demonstrated that they are engaging with companies who clearly have links with intelligence agencies in other countries? What does that mean for my personal data as an Indian citizen? How can I actually trust my government to keep me secure when it's clearly showing me information about the fact that they are negotiating contracts with companies who actually very closely work with the CIA and other US intelligence? We also have some other smaller problems in India with the whole rollout. It's a program that has to be launched to 1.2 billion people, and we expect some problems. But what kind of problems have we had? This is true. There were some UID cards found where the picture was actually not a person, but sometimes a dog or a tree or a chair. The UIDAI accepted this and said, oh yeah, we have some problems. It's a system that we're still perfecting. It'll all work eventually. They said there are enough safeguards to make sure that this cannot be misused. But with all the independent contractors that they're working with, there are other worries, such as somebody actually found about 2,000 Aadhaar applications with personal information already in there on the roadside in a small town in the state of Kerala in South India. More recently, there was a fake UID card scam busted in the state of Gujarat in a city called Surat. And they actually found equipment that has been authorized to be used only by the UIDAI, which was lent by people who work for the UIDAI to people who were making these fake Aadhaar cards. Let's go back to that issue I have with centralized storage and access of this data. Now, this is somebody who is a researcher with the MIT Geospatial Data Center said, which I really like, so I thought I'd quote it here. It says, what is personal information? Personal information is personal property. It belongs to the person. Unless it is put in the public domain, the ownership of that personal information remains with that person. Which means I should not have to give away my data to anybody who wants to put it in a large centralized database. Sunil Abraham, who's the director of Center for Internet and Society in Bangalore, recently said this. He said, what India needs is an evil Snowden. The problem with Snowden is that he has conscience. Everything that he's leaked so far, he's done it extremely responsibly and made sure that he's actually protecting innocent citizens from any harm. Think about what implications it would have if someone, say a whistleblower who works for UIDAI, or someone with the wrong intentions, decides and has access to this data, decides to just take all of this data, put it out as a torrent online. Now that's all our personally identifiable information available publicly to everybody, which is extremely dangerous, as you can imagine. And I would not advise anybody to do that, but this is a possibility that we have to consider. And that is why centralized storage of such data is harmful to society and has these vulnerabilities. Nandan Nilekani, who is the chief and chairman of the UIDAI, said, when asked, what is it that the UIDAI can be used for? Why are you building this? He said, we are providing an open architecture which allows people to build applications on top of it. He was asked a few other questions which he came out with very similar vague answers to. So basically, what this implies is that the UIDAI and the Government of India and the Planning Commission just got together and said, let's just launch this system, let's get all this data in, we'll figure out what to do with it later. What's important is that we need to get all this data in there. Now, clearly, what is that about? It's like, to me, it means, okay, that is clearly about establishing control. That is about what I was talking about earlier, the fact that the state wants to know what you are and where you are and who you are at all times. And it's not the first time that centralized databases like that have been built, and in the past we know they have been misused. And let's talk about biometrics for a second. Now, The UID project is collecting my fingerprints, and they intend to use this as authentication. There's a problem with that. The fact that my fingerprints are used as authentication have several problems, and the primary one is that biometrics are not cancelable. If they're compromised, my fingerprint is compromised, I cannot go get a new one. And they cannot be resecured, unlike other digital forms of authentication, which I can actually revoke and create a new one if necessary, if they are compromised. And digital signatures also, like we all know, other digital encryption methods don't require centralized storage. And they're definitely more resilient in terms of security that way, because, for example, my ATM pin, I can revoke it if I lose my card, if someone actually figures my pin out, I can revoke it. I cannot do that with my fingerprint. And in such a large context, when you're actually trying to use biometrics, well, biometrics are not infallible. Especially when you're using it in a population with 1.2 billion people, there are inaccuracies that can arise from variations in individual attributes and inaccuracies in the technology. They can also change in response to a number of things, a number of factors, which is like the environment, stress, activity, illness, and age. This is something that there is a lot of proof about. And there is a whole possibility of error when you're doing this with 1.2 billion people. And then let's talk about technology for a bit. Like, it really depends on the accuracy of the technology. Like, there's many aspects in biometric technology that can affect this. There's calibration, sensors, algorithms, and you don't go about piloting a system like this on the whole country without thinking about these issues or testing them. And it is possible to fake fingerprints. We know that. The Chaos Computer Club in the past has shown us how to do that. There's a lot of other people who've shown us how to do that. A quick Google search for fake fingerprints will give you a lot of information about how you can actually do that. Also, in the Indian context, there is a lot of commercial motivation for people to create fake or spoof identities, which has happened a lot. So, for example, we've known of bank managers to achieve their targets, creating what we call Benami accounts. What these mean are people who don't, well, these are basically ghost identities. People who don't actually exist have bank accounts because there are certain targets that banks have to achieve. There's also been reports of how biometric systems have been misused, where you can actually use image manipulation software to create fake biometrics, create unique fake fingerprints, and there's nothing stopping you from actually buying a bunch of fingerprints from another country, which has been done before. Not at this scale, and it can actually be done at this scale. And all this lets you create these unique identities and create these ghost identities, which the UID system will accept as long as it is unique. So this is in a 23-page biometrics report that the UID AI put out a little while ago, which said biometric data by them is collected by software provided by the UID AI, which immediately encrypts and applies a digital signature. So if that encryption and applying a digital signature works for the UID AI, clearly it should work for citizens. Why do we need biometrics to protect us then? So those are the issues and those are the questions I ask about the whole Aadhaar project a lot. And this is something that has been talked about a lot too, that the Aadhaar project itself is completely unconstitutional. Actually, there is no legal framework in the Constitution that makes this constitutional, and it's just an executive committee decision which has actually not been passed by the parliament. It has no parliamentary oversight. So, as far as I'm concerned, as a citizen of India governed by the Constitution of India, I see there is no accountability or transparency in this project. Like I said earlier, the Supreme Court ruled Aadhaar numbers were not mandatory, which is, yeah, we'll see what happens with that. Let's talk about some other things that worry me and some others at the moment. The steps that the government has been taking in surveilling us, intercepting our communications, and how that's played out over the last few years. I'll give you a little bit of context, a little bit of history. In 2011, the government of India put out something called IT Rules 2011, which basically prohibits websites and service providers from hosting information that could be regarded as harmful, blasphemous, insulting to India. They also mandated that all internet cafes were now required to install surveillance cameras in their premises. And for a while, the Indian government, the IT rules also now say this, require anybody who uses a cyber cafe in India to hand out their ID card to the person who runs it, who has to keep a record of clearly, my computer is not happy with this. I have to give out my personal identification every time I want to use internet in a public space in India. And at the same time, there's a camera watching me and looking behind my shoulder to see what I'm doing. India also has a history of being a country that has been asking service providers to give out a lot of user data. They actually sent the second highest number of requests after the US in 2012 to Google asking for user data. There's also an act in the IT Amendment Act of also a section in the IT Amendment Act of 2008 which is called Section 66A. What this says is you can actually be imprisoned for up to 3 years for sending an email or any other electronic message that causes annoyance or inconvenience. Now, in the face of it, what this section is supposed to do is protect innocent citizens from online harassment. But there's been several instances in the recent past where it's been misused. In fact, there's misused by political leaders who've got people arrested for causing annoyance or inconvenience to them. In October this year, a resident of Chennai, the city in South India, posted a tweet. He had 16 followers on Twitter, 16. He posted a tweet to his 16 followers claiming that he knew that a certain politician in South India who happens to be a member of the ruling, the current central ruling party. The politician, in this case, his name is Kadri Chidambaram, who also happens to be the son of the present finance minister of the government of India. He tweeted saying, Chidambaram had amassed more wealth than this other person who is the son-in-law of the chief of the Congress party, who are the ruling party in the country. His tweet basically had a few words. It says, Chidambaram seems to have amassed more wealth than Robert Wadra. That's basically all he said. He was arrested. And because Chidambaram filed a police complaint a few days after he saw this tweet. A university professor in West Bengal last year was arrested after being assaulted by the party in power, some members of the party in power there, was arrested and jailed because he emailed a spoof, a cartoon of Mamata Banerjee, who is the chief minister of that state. And, well, more recently, India actually lost one of its most powerful political leaders earlier this year, Bal Thackeray, who led this right-wing political party called the Shiv Sena and was a very powerful politician, especially in the state of Maharashtra, where Mumbai is. And when he died, the government decided, out of respect, to shut down the city of Mumbai. Now, Bal Thackeray, interestingly, although he was an extremely powerful political leader, never held any kind of position of power in the government. He was never the chief minister or any other minister in any government. So when the government decided to shut down the city of Mumbai, a lot of people thought, but he's not really a political leader who's ever held an office, so why? Two girls actually were arrested because they posted questioning this shutdown in the city on Facebook. So yeah, those are examples of how the 66A has been misused by political leaders. And this is a section which actually is supposed to prevent me from harassment. But yeah. And they also launched something called the telephone call interception system in 2011. What the TCIS lets the government do is monitor in real time 900 million landlines and mobiles in the country. And all this snooping is invisible. You don't know if you're being monitored. It's completely transparent and seamless. It not just monitors you, but it also does voice recognition and pattern matching based on other sample data that exists in the system to determine if you are a terrorist or not. More recently, while actually in earlier in the year when we were all shocked and the global dialogue started around the Snowden leaks, India quietly started launching this system called the Central Monitoring System, which was conceptualized after the attacks in Mumbai in 2008. And this CMS will also integrate with what I mentioned earlier, which is the telephone call interception system. And this claims to be, they claim that it'll be rolled out to a dozen states by 2014. So what the CMS does is basically bypasses your ISP and plugs straight into each ISP. So the Indian government can then, well, monitor and intercept all communications that are digital in real time. It can be used to monitor your social media activity. It can be used to monitor your email activity, your telephone calls, and your mobile calls. And it also claims to do real-time monitoring of your location using GPS. Now, who is it that authorizes or decides on the selection of targets that can be targeted through this surveillance? Now, the agencies that actually have access to this data are not required to seek a court order to do any surveillance anymore. They don't need to ask a service provider anymore for data. They can just get it because they have access to the central system. These are the agencies and authorities that have access to data. That's a lot of agencies. And I was looking at this list and I suddenly went, hey, why is the Central Board of Direct Taxes surveilling me? Why is it that the tax office needs to have real-time capabilities to intercept my communications? When did suspicion of tax evasion legally justify a wiretap? And why is it that someone who forgot to pay their tax or is avoiding their tax is now suddenly a terrorist? which is what these systems are supposed to fight, right? Terrorism. The Cabinet Secretary of India actually in 2011 said economic offenses are not public emergencies. I don't think we even needed someone to make a statement like that. The CMS will monitor 160 million internet users, and since it ties into the TCIS, which I spoke about earlier, will monitor 900 million mobiles and landlines and will do location-based monitoring using GPS. So like Bruchner said, they're doing all this monitoring to look for people who might be terrorists. He says, searching for a terrorist through data mining is like looking for a needle in a haystack. To use, imagine a slightly more real-life example, it's almost like going, the only way we can actually protect, say, the city of Hamburg is if we collect everybody's keys for their private properties and deposit them with the police. And that's the only way we can actually protect them. So we need all the data, all everybody's data, so we can actually then figure out who amongst all these people, by looking at their keys, is a terrorist. And they also set up a system called the National Intelligence Grid, which is this integrated intelligence network where a lot of databases that are owned by several departments in the government are now being linked together. This was again proposed after the 2008 attacks, and recently, a few days ago, I read a report saying they're actually now starting to launch this, and it's supposedly going to be active by the end of this year or early next year. NatGrid again links several different departments of the Indian government. And once again, it includes the tax department, which I seem to have missed in the slide, but it is there, yeah, Central Board of Direct Taxes. So what does all this mean for us? One thing to note with all this happening in the country is that India actually doesn't have a dedicated privacy law. Also, the kind of protections we have around data are not really governed by a dedicated data protection law. So where does that leave us, and what are the steps we are taking or we can take to actually exercise the rights that we have as citizens? The Center for Internet and Society, where Maria, who I mentioned earlier, works, is actually drafting a new privacy protection bill. They've done it in an extremely collaborative manner where they've invited members of general public, policymakers, lawmakers, activists, and private enterprise folks to come together and work on this series of about 7 roundtables, if I remember correctly. So that's happening. The reason that an organization that is not the government is doing this is because the Indian government has not done this. So there is someone else, a bunch of people actually sitting together and going, okay, let's build a privacy bill and see if we can protect our privacy. There are things one can do as a technologist, and this is what I think a lot of us can do, is, let's use strong crypto, which actually helps us protect our data ourselves, our communications ourselves, and not rely on other agencies or governments to give us this protection. As technologists, a lot of people I know have been running a lot of trainings, including Tactical Tech, who I work with, and the Crypto Party movement, who've been teaching other people how to use crypto and make all this technology accessible to people who don't have the technical knowledge to protect themselves from being snooped online. And of course, I think all of us should be thinking a little more about changing our online behavior, our digital habits. It's really easy, very little thing, like there's very small little things one can do to actually protecting ourselves, including using good crypto and reading privacy policies or changing our privacy settings to make sure we're not giving up more data We should. And of course, there's a lot of information that the government of India has not made available to us. And one thing that many activists and others are doing is filing right to information petitions or signing online petitions and actually asking for this information from the government by writing to them through various means. And that, I think, should continue in every context. And that is something we intend to continue doing. And I am of the strong belief, and I was actually talking to a colleague yesterday, and we kind of agreed on this, that change doesn't happen unless a bunch of people actually go out onto the streets and ask for it. There's a good example of that right now in India. Yesterday, the state of New Delhi, which is also the capital of India, there's a new chief minister who was sworn in yesterday. And he comes from a party called the Aam Aadmi Party, which translates to, well, loosely translates to Common People's Party. Now, why this party came into being is because a lot of people in India, a lot of activists who were not politicians, launched a large campaign against corruption, in which they motivated millions of people to come out onto the streets and protest against this. And we actually are seeing change from that. We'll see how that plays out. We don't know. But the fact that less than a year ago, this party did not exist, and today it's actually in power in our national capital, means that people going out on the streets and protesting can actually change things. So it's really important for us to encourage people to go out onto the streets. I was in Berlin a few months ago, and I felt really liberated when I marched in the Freedom Not Fear protest, where 12,000 people in the city of Berlin were out on the streets trying to reclaim their digital freedoms and telling the state, no, you cannot spy on us, you cannot scan us. And I think it's important for us right now to try and motivate people in India to try and do something similar. So, yeah, I'll just leave you with that. And I think just to go back to that notion of privacy that I started with, there's a lot of people thinking about this in India, and the fact that the question that keeps being asked is privacy dead? Does privacy even exist in the Indian context? I just think it's probably differently configured in the Indian society, but it's definitely not dead. And fortunately for us, there's a lot of amazing people, organizations, individuals, and other institutions and activists who think the same and are actually making calls in different ways to protect this important human right. So I'll leave you with that. I'm happy to talk more about what's going on in India and actually brainstorm some ideas about what else we should think about and what we can do. But yeah, thank you very much.
All right, we still have some time left for Q&A. Are there any questions? Please go to the mics over there and over there. Do we have questions from the internet? No questions from the internet. Over there.
Thanks. Thanks to the mic. Yeah. Thanks for the very insightful speech. Interesting. It's a bit scary, actually. So I got a couple of questions. I took a couple of notes. The first one is, how long did it take in overall? I mean, the situation is kind of scary. And so how long in overall did it take to the country to like get into this kind of massive private data collection, surveillance of everything? How many years did it take?
So a lot of the actual schemes I spoke about today were conceptualized after the attacks in 2011 in Mumbai, which was a very critical, very large landmark event in India. And a lot of this actually is still being piloted and has not been implemented. So this is actually a good time when we are trying to get more information from the government and understand how these systems work to protest against this and see if we can actually get them to change their minds slightly and think about these things differently. But over the last 5 years is when most of these systems have been conceptualized. Okay.
So a couple of more questions. So do you think, I mean, we've seen the links between some private companies that are obviously linked to the CIA for the database making. Do you think, or do you have any piece of evidence that would let you think that there was some US pressure to build such systems?
No, there isn't any evidence, but it does raise questions, right? It's like, why is it that they've consistently gone and negotiated these contracts and put them in place with companies that have clear links that have been exposed to intelligence agencies? It just doesn't make me feel safe as a citizen of a country where the government is negotiating deals with someone who might be linked and might be compromising my personal information to an intelligence agency, a foreign intelligence agency. So,
okay. And last one: what can non-Indian people do to help?
Sorry.
If they want? What can non-Indian people do if they want to help somehow?
So, it's okay. So there is it's obviously a global dialogue and a discourse that's very important right now. And one of the things that is true, which I didn't mention earlier, is that it doesn't really just affect Indian citizens. It affects a lot of other people, considering the fact that there are no privacy bills and no data protection laws, and the amount of data that is being invested into India from other countries, including all the business that is being outsourced into India, should be a cause of worry to a lot of other people who are not in India. So we obviously need global pressure and people to actually understand what's happening in India, which is, I think, what we've been doing, reporting on current events of what's happening and what that means in the larger global context. So there's a lot of things one can think about doing, including just starting to ask these questions about, okay, if my data is living in India, is it safe? And what does that mean to me if I'm not there? And ask these questions not just to the Indian government, but to your to people who are actually dealing with your data where you are. Yeah.
Thank you.
All right, we have a question at one.
Okay, at first I will thank you too for your good view, to give us a view on this faraway subcontinent India. We work in Germany as a watchdog group to monitor big enterprises. And you mentioned two of them, Accenture and L1. L1, I never heard of them. We work almost on German enterprise, Bertelsmann, who are holding a big personal database on the Germans and European people. I think our view is shaped through the media in this NSA scandal. The big enterprises are showed us as the poor guys who are blackmailed from the secret services, CIA, NSA, and so on. But from our view as a watchdog group, the enterprises have very strong own interests. And you mentioned at the end of your presentation that a fight against corruption may be a good idea to go into this connection between government, secret services, and the enterprises. And maybe Accenture is changed the name of this enterprise several years ago because they are linked with one of the biggest corruption scandals of the Western world. It was the Enron scandal, and so we can see where the fight against corruption and the fight for more privacy are linked together. My question is, can you tell me more about L1, perhaps?
So, well, there's actually very little information that we have in this specific context about L1, but they've basically been building, well, they've been basically doing a lot of consulting and offering a lot of consulting services to defense and global security, like I said earlier. And they were also actually, they're actually major supplier of biometric identification software, and which is used by the US to monitor terrorists and insurgents in Iraq and Afghanistan. And they're very closely linked to the CIA. And one of the things, if I now remember correctly, is that they've been, they were recently employed by the Department of Homeland Security, and I'm just trying to see if I can find some notes I have here which I can give you more specific information about without having to break my memory for this, but...
Maybe you could handle that off stage later.
Yeah, maybe. I have more details about L1, which I am happy to share if we talk in the halls, maybe.
Okay. How big is this L1? Have you?
Well,
some statistics.
The public information on their website says they have over 1,000 specialists who have, and a lot of them have top security clearances.
This is quite big. Okay. Yeah.
All right, then I'd say thank you very much, Hound B, for this great talk, and another round of warm applause, please.